Okay, good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining this media call. My name is Suzanne Schaefer. I'm a communications manager at the Brookings Institution. We can just go ahead and get started. I'll just briefly introduce our four experts for today. We have Samantha Gross, who is the director of our Energy Security and Climate Initiative and a fellow in foreign policy at Brookings, followed by Nathan Holtman, who's a non-resident senior fellow in our Global Economy and Development Program. We also have Amar Bhattacharya, who is a senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program as well, and Sanjay Patnik, who is the director on the Center on Regulations and Markets and the Bernard L. Schwartz Chair in Economic Policy Development and a fellow in Economic Studies. So our four excellent experts here are going to give you all some brief opening remarks. And then we will have most of the time of this call dedicated to your questions. So if you do have questions at any point throughout this call, please feel free to type them in the chat box. And then when I turn to Q&A, you're also welcome to raise your hand or come on video and ask your question directly. As a reminder, we are recording. This is on the record. And I will have a transcript that I'll send out to all of you about 24 hours afterward. So with that, I think we can just go ahead and get started. So Samantha, take it away.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone for joining us this morning or this afternoon where I am. I'm actually working in Berlin for a few months. And I'll speak mostly about the announcement of the US NDC, the Nationally Determined Contribution under the Paris Agreement that's coming this week. And there is just no question that that people here in Europe and environmentalists in the United States fully expect the U.S. to come up with an NDC of at least a 50% reduction below 2005 levels by 2030. I think anything less ambitious than this that will be seen as totally unacceptable by folks both in the U.S. and here in Europe. But it seems to me that President Biden is in a bit of a bind. He has to deal with the Congress that he has. But I believe that Congress, particularly the Republicans, haven't really kept up with increasing concern among the American public about climate. But he has to work with what he has. So I see sweeping climate legislation. A lot of people have asked me about cap and trade or a carbon tax, and I just don't see that as being likely. But at least bills can come to a vote in the Senate now, which is a big change from the McConnell years when climate legislation just simply couldn't even get to the floor for an up or down vote in the Senate. The thing I'm most curious about, actually, I think we have some idea of what the NDC will be, but I'm curious about what lies on the pages behind it. And that's the policies that are planned to implement the NDC. And I expect to see a lot of carrots mixed into this policy, a lot of funding and tax breaks for low carbon technology and infrastructure, and for research and commercialization of low carbon technology. Regulation under existing laws is also possible and likely, but I fear that regulation will face the same fate as it did under the Obama administration, when we saw the Trump administration try to roll back things that Obama had done. And most importantly, I worry that the fear of such reversal and then the endless litigation that comes along with this will dampen the investment signal that the regulation was intended to send. And so that's a concern of mine as we go forward. But I expect that regulation under existing laws will be another important tool that the Biden administration will use. I'll add that the world has really changed over the last 4 years. I think Americans have become more concerned. I think that there is public support for action on climate. And that's why I think it's so interesting that climate bills or climate-related bills will be able to get to the Senate floor now and actually get an up or down vote. Because you may see Republicans voting against programs that their constituents may like. And so we may see some more ambitious things pass than we thought in the past. And I'll close my opening remarks just by saying that the U.S. is on a really different path than Europe. And I've noticed that a lot since I've been here. In Europe, they're very focused on the emissions trading system and really focused on carbon prices as one of their primary mechanisms to achieve their lofty climate goals. However, even here, it's really hard to get a carbon price high enough to do the really hard work of getting to, in Europe, the 55% reduction that they're looking for by 2030. Another thing I'll note, and I can talk about it later if anybody's interested, is that there's a real focus on ideological purity here in Europe. Whereas in the US, there seems to be more of a focus among scholars and policymakers on focusing on what works and multiple pathways being possible. And if one pathway doesn't work, we'll move. And that's something about US strategy that I find encouraging. And so I'll leave it there and pass it on to my compatriots.
Thanks, Samantha. Nathan, over to you.
Great. So hi, everybody. Nate Holtman, and thanks, Samantha, for those great introductory comments. Let me build on that a little bit. I think, you know, one way to you know, we're at this moment. We know there's a big President Biden convened summit happening this week. I think it's worth pausing just to note we're at the confluence of a number of positive trends in the climate world this year. And I think it's kind of helps to pause and sort of see what those trends are and to kind of think about what they might mean in terms of this year, longer term success, but also what kind of the challenges are as well. So the trends that we're seeing, first of all, like obviously the one that we're all aware of and talking about right now is that we have a U.S. federal re-engagement on climate. You know, President Biden's come into office, you know, the Congress, as Samantha was, I think, eloquently stating a few minutes ago, is in a different mode right now in terms of its orientation on climate and its ability to engage on this topic and potentially pass legislation. So that's a clear new element. But that's also coming on the heels of a number of other important trends. So first of all, you know, as over the last 4 years, while the U.S. federal leadership has been absent from the international stage, a number of other countries have been moving forward. And we might hear from some of our other speakers a little bit about that as well. But I think it's really important to note that even in the recent 6 months, we've had new and sometimes surprising announcements from different players, different actors in the global community, including China, announcing a 2060 net zero target, as well as a number of others, the EU and others sort of coming out with their intent for an ambitious climate strategy that will deliver significant reductions, not only to 2030, but also beyond. So that's a second element. A third element that we've been seeing is the kind of thinking about what's happened in the US. And I think it's important here to remember what happens in the US, Samantha was talking about this a little bit as well, is not only best viewed through the lens of who's the president, although that is quite important, or even for that matter, from the federal, including Congress, but is best viewed as sort of what's happening across the country. And I think if we look at that story over the last 5 to 7 years, what we've seen is, yes, a story of sort of high presidential ambition, then low, then now high again. But more fundamentally, a changing trend over those years of increasing and increasingly accelerating action from the subnationals in the US. So states, cities, businesses, and others. And I think if we look at sort of what makes change happen in the US, it's always really important to note that that change is not something that happens only at the federal level, but is rooted across all this kind of all of society change. And what we have seen in the last few years is quite consistent with that kind of a story. Change not only driven by state houses, city councils, mayors, and what have you, all of which, by the way, can add up to a significant amount even on its own. But also that's reflective, I think, as Samantha noted as well, of a changing public sentiment. And so that's an important sort of third element of the confluence of events. And the fourth one I'm just going to put on the table, always happening in the background, is a shift in the market dynamics. So we have changes in technology costs. This is a story that you all are familiar with. But over the past 7-10 years, we've seen these rapid and sustained drops in clean energy technology costs. That does matter over this time. Like it drives, you know, it drives a more quick sort of opportunity for more accelerated deployment of clean energy technologies. It makes the shift away from fossil more plausible and politically palatable. And it really is sort of sets up a backdrop for increased action. And so those are the kind of elements that are in place today. Now, what do we need to make those elements sort of sing together and deliver something of high ambition? And so I'll say this briefly, because I know we have other speakers and we can always talk more in the Q&A. But I think first and foremost, the U.S. is now re-entering the stage of international climate leadership. The summit this week is focused on that. And so what can the U.S. do? It can certainly bring the actors together. We can come up with a strategy for delivering on success across all of this kind of international community, thinking about not only this one moment, but also all of the moments happening this year into the climate conference later this year, but even beyond, because this is a long-term effort. In order for that to be successful, we have to have the U.S. step up with a climate target of its own that reflects our national climate strategy in a way that's plausible and grounded in the politics of today and also the evolution of those trends that I mentioned. But it does have to be ambitious. It has to be something that is informed by the science and also kind of is challenging for us to get to. And just because it's challenging doesn't mean it's painful, but we do need to kind of continue to act. So that's an essential and critical component of the staging this week. In order for the U.S. to become an international leader again, we have to also be presenting a kind of ambitious and achievable U.S. domestic target. So I think maybe I'll leave it there. Happy to talk more about any of this. But maybe, Suzanne, should I just pass directly, I think, to Amar?
Yeah, Amar, over to you.
Okay.
Thanks, Nate.
Thank you, Nate. So I just want to build on that and talk a little bit about the global agenda against the backdrop of the summit that will be taking place. And at a personal level, I will say that, you know, the leadership that has been, you know, injected, not by just the event, but the work that has gone into the event, and particularly the efforts of John Kerry, are already beginning to make a big, big difference on the global scene. There's a new sense of energy. But let me make 4 points about, you know, what's at stake and, you know, what the big ticket items are. The first is, you know, the clear indication that, you know, we have to ramp up and there is a much greater urgency. And this is a strong theme right now. And it is centered around the target of getting to net zero emissions by mid-century. And implicit in that is a recognition that 1.5 degrees is an imperative, no longer something aspirational. So the idea is to get everybody to buy into a collective goal of net zero emissions by mid-century and translate that into concrete commitments. The first step of that is to set targets for 2030. Now, on the 2030, we can come back to that in question. There is two things that you should keep in mind, that these reduction targets have two benchmarks. One is 1990, the other is 2005. And so, you know, countries variably use 1990 and 2005. So the US target everybody is talking about is 2005. The European target of 55% cut is actually from a base of 1990. If you took 2005 for Europe, it would be closer to 50%. So it's important to keep that in mind. So urgency is the first point. And as the US pushes on this, it can put more pressure on others to step up, including China, and including getting other big emitters such as India, Indonesia, and the like on board. Second, that conversation has changed very much to the opportunity of climate action, especially in the COVID context. In rebuilding or building back better, there is a great opportunity to actually kind of tackle the fragilities and risks that had been building in before the pandemic. There is an opportunity to put the world on a trajectory with a much greater sort of benefits in terms of innovation, in terms of productivity, in terms of the co-benefits of climate action. So there has been a shift from the costs of climate action now and a focus on zero-sum game to the benefits and the opportunities, and including the opportunities for cooperative action. Third, in order to achieve this, there is a recognition that we will have to scale up investments significantly, especially in sustainable infrastructure. So there is a direct link, for example, between the sustainable infrastructure package that is being discussed in the US and climate ambition. And that ambition will be much, much greater for developing countries than it will be for advanced economy. And the last part, therefore, of the agenda that the US has set out is a recognition that developing countries and emerging markets will need significant support with finance, with technology, and with adaptation. So there is, in my view, all the right boxes ticked off for the summit. You know, I think the test will be how much concreteness leaders will come to the summit with, but also the pressure that will be exercised by the summit so that by the end of the year, we can have, in some sense, a set of agreements that really takes us, you know, to the level, next level beyond Paris. Let me stop there.
Great. Thank you, Amar. And Sanjay, over to you.
Great. Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. My name is Sanjay Patnaik. I want to build a little bit and expand a bit further on what Samantha has said before, which is really about setting the policy instruments domestically to achieve anything we commit to internationally. So obviously, as my previous speakers have said, it is a great signal that the US is back at the table, at the negotiating table on international climate front, and that especially Biden is really focusing on basing the decisions only on science and building bridges to our allies. But I think the big question that will be on everyone's mind is how do we get there, right? How do we get there credibly? Because we have seen that for the last 20 years, I would say, where we have seen really extreme swings from doing a lot on climate, or at least announcing to do a lot on climate, and then going back and doing nothing. And so even starting in 2000, a lot of you might remember the Kyoto Protocol, which President Bush pulled out of, and then we had 8 years of almost no climate action. And then President Obama came in, and under Trump, it was a lot of it was reversed again. And so the question is, what can Biden do to actually implement those emissions reductions? Because he has a limited a set of policy tools. As all economists agree, the ideal policy tool that would move the needle is a carbon price. But as Samantha already alluded, that is very unlikely to happen in Congress in whatever form. We've seen that even 2010, that the Democrats were not able to pass it, even though they controlled the House and the Senate and the presidency. And so then the question is, what else is Biden left with? And so there are a couple of things where he already has taken actions. One is obviously executive orders. The problem with executive orders is they can be reversed very easily by someone who comes in next. He has taken some very important one, I think, especially in terms of signaling, like redrawing the Paris Agreement, like revoking the Keystone Pipeline, and also putting out an executive order that really is focused on tackling the climate crisis, which takes the whole of government approach. I think that is where he has had an impact so far, because it really tries to reorient all federal agencies and parts of the government towards climate as a major issue to tackle and climate risks to try to mitigate those. The second step he can take is through regulation, right? And this comes through the agencies. President Obama largely relied on the EPA. What we see with Biden, I think, is that we will obviously see the actions we expect through the EPA, but he will also move quite a bit on the financial market side through the SEC. We have seen already that the SEC put out a request for comments on climate disclosure, and so is soliciting comments from the public and from stakeholders on potential standards for climate disclosure. And that would put the US in lockstep with other countries. And so I think where President Biden really can have an impact, and where we maybe can convince our international partners that there are measures that we're taking that will be not as easily reversed as we have seen in the past when another administration comes in, is if regulatory action and policy action that Biden takes reinforces existing market trends. And so if market trends, which we already are seeing, are going towards a low carbon economy. And we have seen that around the world, for instance, with investors increasingly pulling out of fossil fuel projects, with investors increasingly demanding climate disclosure and forcing firms to actually disclose how vulnerable they are to climate risks. and putting out a plan to actually mitigate those climate risks. So I think if Biden, with concerted actions, can reinforce those trends in a way that the market moves along more quickly, and that also goes a little bit to what Samantha said about the carrot and the stick approach, that you can do so with carrots by providing incentives for new technology, for electrification, things like that, but also through the stick approach, through financial market regulation, where you look at public companies and how they can disclose climate risk. I think one important point to keep in mind is something Larry Fink recently mentioned, is that if you go the route of climate disclosure, that applies to publicly traded companies. That doesn't apply to private companies. So there is a real risk that some of those dirty or carbon-intensive activities will shift over to private firms. That could be avoided with a carbon price, which, I think we will only see on a regional level, as we have seen in California so far. So I think Biden has a difficult task, going back to Samantha's original point, of at the same time basically telling the world America is back, but also making a commitment. What does that mean? And does that mean these measures are here to stay? Or does it mean if we get a new administration 4 years, everything will be reversed, right? And so I think one thing that is really important to keep in mind is that the world is moving on. So the back and forth in the United States that we have seen on the domestic policy front of climate is very unusual for most developed countries. Most developed countries have set a carbon policy, a climate policy, and they have continued on that path, which is good for everyone because it's good for businesses. They can plan for it. It's good for policymakers. They don't have to back and forth. And it's good for the continuity of regulations. And so I think the question will really be, how can Biden convince the world? And I think there are a lot of measures, at least, that he can try to take that could reinforce some of those trends that we see and work with our partners to do so. I hope it wasn't too pessimistic, but we can explore some of these issues further in the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for those remarks. We're going to turn it over to Q&A now. So as I said earlier, if you do have a question, you can feel free to type that question in the chat or let me know via chat or by unmuting yourself that you would like to pose a question directly. You're all welcome to come on camera or stay off camera and just say your question out loud as well. But just to kick things off, I'll go ahead and pose a question that we received from a reporter on the line, Chloe Ferran, who asks, do you expect any announcement on a U.S. climate finance package at the summit? What key elements will you be looking out for? Could we expect any announcement on ending fossil fuel finance overseas? And what will it tell us if Biden does not announce a climate finance package? So whoever would like to take a stab at that.
So I'll start. Others may have other views. So I think what I'll say is probably not that helpful, Chloe. It's possible. I do know that it's something that is part of the agenda for this year, both in the U.S. thinking as well as kind of globally. I think that one of the questions that always comes up with these summits is what is possible to negotiate on a short timeline and what will need more work. This is one of those things that is complex and difficult. And let's all remember that the Biden team has had about 2 months, 2.5 months or something to kind of do the entire process of not only pulling together the summit, but also pulling together the USNDC. I was involved in that process in the White House and in the Obama team. It is not a trivial job to come up with the NDC. So they've been working quite hard. And I know, as Amar mentioned, John Kerry's also been very active pursuing a number of lines of discussion with international partners. This is one of those lines of discussion. And I don't know that we'll hear anything concrete at the summit. But I also just to your question, I think if we don't hear anything at the summit, that should not be seen as a signal that it won't be forthcoming this year. That's kind of the point I wanted to make. Amar, you've also been following the finance discussions. I wonder if you have any insight into this.
Yeah, so on the fossil fuel finance, support overseas, this is indeed a low-hanging fruit, but the U.S. can't act alone. It needs to act in concert with other G7 countries and indeed with China. So I would see this as a very, very concrete area to push for. So there are several dimensions of it. One is the cessation of coal financing, which has primarily come from Japan and China and to some extent from Korea. I think that is the first priority of cessation. But more broadly, I think, all kind of fossil fuel investment support right now should measure up to, is it consistent with a kind of a net zero objective for that country? So this is one area where many of us are pushing very hard for the G7 to come together on.
And I think, just to add to this, one important signal that Biden will have to send, and I've heard a lot of conversations or trends in that direction, is that the U.S. phases out subsidies for fossil fuels first, right, domestically. It would be very hard to kind of like convince our partners to do so abroad or overseas if we don't do it domestically. And I do think that Biden is moving that direction. I don't know if he will announce it this week. I think it's even part of the infrastructure plan already to some degree. But this would be, again, going to the credible commitment of what is the U.S. doing before going overseas.
So I have a question that I'll pose from Howard Lefrenke, and then I'll turn to questions that we received from Sean Tandon and Stephanie Ebbs in the chat. So Howard asks, President Biden's China policy might be summed up in three words: compete, confront, cooperate. Confronting when necessary and cooperating when possible. Climate is an area where the president wants to cooperate with China, and John Kerry's recent China trip seems to suggest that cooperation with China on climate can work. But is that the full picture? What's the evidence that cooperation with China can produce results? And what would it take from China to make cooperation on climate more than an aspiration?
I think, I can start on this. If we, one thing that if you look at the cooperation that China has on the climate front, they're working extremely closely together with the Europeans. And the reason for that is that the Europeans have led by example, and they have instituted their carbon market since 2005. And so now the EU is basically providing a lot of technical assistance and advice to the Chinese to develop their own carbon markets. So I think collaboration on specific policy tools and on specifics and even technical expertise on how to achieve some of those emissions reductions is a way where the US could collaborate closely with China. And the US has a lot of capacity in that regard. We have the California cap and trade that has a lot of experience in designing a cap and trade program in the carbon market. And we even have quite a lot of expertise at the EPA. So I think that would be one way where the US could work with China, similar to what the Europeans have done.
Just to add to that, so the US and China are co-chairing the G20 Working Group on Sustainable Finance, which has been elevated to a working group. And China actually has been very active in the green finance and sustainable finance area. So this is clear, that is clearly an area where the US and China could work together. I think, as Nate points out in the chat, it's extremely important also to have China buy in to the sustainability and climate agenda, because China is the largest overseas financier of infrastructure in the world. So in some sense, getting China to buy in to the climate agenda is not just a question of what China does within its own borders, but what China does outside its borders as well. So that's an area that I think there's tremendous scope for cooperation. And the third area is technology. China is the largest producer of PV panels. It's investing very heavily in further developments, including on the grid front, et cetera. And while there'll always be, in borrowing the language, an element of competition, there's also going to be a lot of potential for cooperation, especially in the rollout of these technologies for countries where cutting emissions really will mean access to technology.
And more on China, to Sean's question, he's curious to hear thoughts on the EU-backed idea of a carbon tax on exports, and if you think that the U.S. Might get behind that as a way to curb Chinese emissions.
I can start with that one, and hopefully my internet's working. It's been hiccuping a little bit. But here in Europe, they are very serious about what they call the carbon border adjustment mechanism, known to everyone here as the CBAM. And every conversation I have had literally has come down to talking about the CBAM. So they're very serious about this. And it's a mechanism to apply the EU carbon price on high carbon imports at the border. And on its face, it sounds like a really elegant way of protecting European industry and pushing decarbonization abroad. But when you start in to get to the details, it's an absolute bear to implement for a number of reasons I could bring up. But nonetheless, Europe seems quite serious about it. But I don't think the US is entirely on board with that. And part of the reason is there's some concern that US industry could also get caught up in the CBAM, the border adjustment tax, because we don't have a carbon price on industry in the United States, and we're not likely to have one in the future. We're likely to work with high carbon industries through more carrot-like policies, things like research and development, funding, tax breaks for low carbon technology, that sort of thing. So I don't see the US getting on board with the European CBAM for that reason. In fact, when John Kerry was here in Europe maybe 3 weeks ago, he had some discussions about the CBAM and suggested to European officials that they hold off on putting it forward until after the COP to see what comes together at the COP, and that it be seen more as a last resort policy than a first principles policy. But I think that first principles idea is what seems to be moving forward here. And we'll have more information on that in June when the EU puts forward its plan to achieve its own NDC.
Are there any further thoughts on that question? All right, then we have a reporter, Arveya Mariani, who wanted to chime in. So Arveya, if you want to unmute yourself.
Hi, thank you very much. On the carbon border adjustment tax, first of all, this is not only a question of Europe, because this is part of a negotiation ongoing with the Chinese side and Xie Zhenhua. And the coming together of the ETS, of the carbon markets, which, by the way, in China has been built throughout and because of exchange of knowledge coming from and with technical assistance from our side, means that basically, and this has been also considered by the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, that we are building a system for international trade agreements, the same as happened with Brexit, that puts and mainstream principles of sustainability and calculation, very, very frankly, calculation, like the supply chain laws that are being passed in Germany, for instance, for GHG content for goods. That means that the exporters, the American exporters, if they want to export into this block, and it's not only Europe, progressively, we are heading towards a system which sees an alignment with China. We have to either comply or stay out. The other thing is, I was looking at the joint statement, the United States-China joint statement, and actually I've seen and I've heard even John Kerry speaking on a number of occasions about the fact that there is an ongoing process. And Dr. Bhattacharya was talking about the G20 working group co-chaired by the Chinese and the United States. That was very silent, but it happened. I mean, it was done very, and this is on a very important element with this green finance, but it's also because on the table of the G20, there is a carbon tax. There is the reform of the WTO, very back in the background. So if that happens with global rules, what happens in the United States has to follow just because of the laws of the market. And I think that for the first time in history, we are at that point where there is a sort of a political consensus, which will go. We are outside of the system of the COP, or the, let's say, or the, I call it like the prisoner's dilemma of the COP, where everybody was there thinking, oh, I'm not going to do that. So I think I'm a bit more optimistic, although it's not going to be easy.
Thank you. Do we have any responses to that?
If I could just add, I think, you know, the point that Avia made right at the end is very important. And that is, you know, climate has now really gone beyond a kind of COP to becoming a central item in the global discussions, in the G7, in the G20. You know, last week, if you looked at the IMF World Bank meetings, it was the central theme. And that's good, because in some sense, it's not only around ambition, but recognizing that the low carbon transition is not just about climate, it's actually a transition to inclusive and sustainable growth. And I agree very much that we are actually at a moment in history where we can, in some sense, bring the growth and climate agendas together in a much more integrated and holistic way. While I have the mic, there was also a question from Marianne. Do you want me to respond to that?
Sure, go ahead.
And so I wanted to say that, yes, in the eyes of the world, there are two things that everybody, that will be central. One is the 100 billion, famous 100 billion commitment, you know, and it will be seen very much as a litmus test on the part of the developed countries going into COP26. And, you know, and so the US has indicated support for that. The UK has indicated strong support for that. But in the end, this is also a very challenging time, because, you know, it's not just a question of delivering it in 1 year, but will that ambition be built upon? Now, the Green Climate Fund figures very much in that context. You know, of the $3 billion that the U.S. had committed to the Green Climate Fund, it only delivered $1 billion. So it has a backlog of $2 billion. And if you look at its share of the next replenishment that was concluded in, you know, in October last year, then, you know, the U.S. has a backlog of an additional $3 billion. So, yes, I would say that the Green Climate Fund, and more broadly, the commitment of the U.S. to providing the finance that will be needed for both the net zero drive, but also, you know, adaptation and resilience will be of critical importance.
All right. Does anybody have any further comments to Arvea's points or to Marianne's question in the chat?
I'd like to add just a quick response to Arvea's points. And that is, this is an observation as an American who's spending a lot of time in Europe talking to Europeans about implementation of their own climate goals. And that is that there is this idea in Europe of the inevitability of carbon pricing, and that this is the way to go, and that it will take place everywhere, and that the markets will drive everyone to adopt a carbon price. And I do see that point, and I understand it, but that point is running, at least right now, into a wall of US politics that are not supportive of carbon pricing. And so at some point, that will come to a head. When and in what way, I'm not sure, but I do somewhat question the Europeans' opinion. And this is not just Arvea, this is many climate-concerned Europeans, that a global carbon price is inevitable, or that they can sort of force a global carbon price, because U.S. politics are not there and are not likely to be there real soon. And how that all plays out is a very interesting question for those of us who think about climate issues.
All right, if we have no further comments on those questions, I'm going to move to Stephanie. So Stephanie asks, what do you see as the most important policies or changes that need to happen for the U.S. to meet the new NDC? So Nate, if you want to go ahead and start with that one.
Great. So thanks for the great question. It's really a fundamental one. We've addressed it kind of in different ways through this conversation. So first, I'm going to note that I really liked Amar's recent framing of thinking about how climate is moved from a kind of climate topic to a kind of all of economy topic. And I think that, you know, all of economy, all of society in the global context, in the international context. And I think that the fundamental answer to this question is that what the U.S. also needs to do is think about climate not being a climate topic, but being an all of economy topic in the United States as well. All of economy, all of society, all sectors, all gases, and all levels of government. And so if we can, you know, we are actually in the midst of, I believe, of such a transition, you know, over the past few years, and potentially now, as I mentioned before, with federal re-engagement, could in fact realize that kind of a strategy. But that is ultimately how we have to be thinking about it, that this is something about a rapid, thoroughgoing energy and economic transition that has significant and generally positive benefits on jobs and economic growth. And actually, Amar and his colleague Nick Stern have done a lot of work on this in a lot of different country contexts. And so for us to be thinking about this as well is the fundamental kind of point. Now, when we get to things like the NDC, I'm going to just put on the table, there's a lot of ways to look at how we can get to an ambitious NDC. And I'm going to note, I'm not going to belabor it right now, but I have two studies on this that you're welcome to take a look at, and I'm happy to kind of connect offline, that are grounded in a global integrated assessment model about different, looking at different policy platforms that have, in my view and in my team's view, a kind of reasonable, plausible policy pathway to success, even under current politics. Some of those look at primarily federal strategies. Some of them look at sort of this integrated, all-in, you know, kind of hybrid non-federal and federal climate strategy. But they both point toward a roughly 50% number. And the point to your question is that what that really implies is pretty significant action across all sectors of the U.S. economy from both federal and non-federal actors. The big heavy hitters, I think, is well accepted, not just from the studies I've been part of, but also from across the community. Electricity and transport are the biggest ones between now and 2030 in the U.S., but other sectors are also critically important to set up, not only to hit an ambitious 2030 number, but to also have continued success toward a 2050 net zero decarbonization goal. So about three quarters of the reductions you're generally going to see come from transport and electricity. The different policies, you know, kind of tools that we use to get there, I think are kind of open. There's a little bit of flexibility with how we can get there in the different sectors. Noting we don't, you know, yes, hypothetically, a carbon price is a very efficient way to deliver carbon reductions. But as Samantha said, that's not what we are looking at in the US right now. And I would argue it's not necessary for us to get to an ambitious number in the US. So there might be some evolution toward that policy tool eventually in the US, but I wouldn't say we need that today. So like I said, more detail, if people are interested, I'm happy to connect separately.
Great, thank you, Nate. Are there any other responses to Stephanie's question? Okay, I think we will now turn to Lisa Friedman, who has her hand up. Lisa, if you'd like to ask your question now.
Hi, thank you guys very much for doing this today. There's how this summit is viewed internationally and how it plays domestically. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, with the U.S. announces a new NDC and China, India, or other major emerging countries do not announce some new targets, what message will that send domestically? Is there a concern that it will just sort of feed this narrative that you know, Republicans have been frankly pushing, that America is doing more than everyone else?
Lisa, I'll start with that question. That's a really tough call, because I think no matter what happens on Thursday and Friday, it's going to get some Republican spin. And I think that's unavoidable. And so I think President Biden needs to focus on what does happen at the meeting, and that this is not the end of the road. This is a small step on a long road, that through all the meetings that will happen this year, like Amar talked about, the G20, the G7, the COP, this summit that happens over the next couple of days. And so there is a possibility that it will be spun that way. But what I hope to see is that no matter what happens, that the response from the administration is that this isn't the end. This is just a step on a long road in a really important year, and that's the way that it's pitched.
And just to build on that, I think it's really important to keep in mind the rest of the world, including India and China, had already committed to a lot of the emissions reductions through the Paris Agreement. The U.S. pulled out and rejoined now. So it is really up to the U.S. to kind of like reestablish the credibility that we are serious about doing something, right? And I think another way to think about it is, especially like with regard to such talking points, when you see who should move first, we have to look at the historic pathway of CO2 emissions in the atmosphere, right? About 70% of the CO2 in the atmosphere currently that has been created after the Industrial Revolution was created by Europe and the United States. So I think it's really important that these two blocks move first, and Europe has. They have really moved early on to establish that kind of like baseline and show to the world we're willing to do so. Only then I think we will see more movement from the other countries. But it is important to keep in mind that those countries have already moved, and they have done quite a lot of measures since the Paris Agreement. I mean, China is launching the largest carbon market in the world in close cooperation with the Europeans. So that is, I think that is a significant step for such a big economy.
All right, thank you. We have a question from Zach Coleman, and then I'll go to Nirmal Ghosh, and we also have a question from Oliver Millman. So Zach asks, or says, maybe this is simple, but where are we at now with emissions reductions in the United States? What are our biggest stretch sectors for emissions reductions and with and without action from Congress?
Start on this one and then maybe pass it on to a couple others who I know will have things to add. I was just surfing around looking for the number on where we are compared to 2005, and I couldn't quite find the number I was looking for, but it's out there. And I believe, Nate, nod if I'm right, it's in the teens reduction since 2005. Yeah, I see him nodding. Okay. So yeah, it's roughly in the teens since 2005. The sectors that are the easiest, certainly the power sector is the easiest. You see renewables being not just popular, but cheap, downright cheap, economic. And that's the reason why the majority of new power you see built in the United States is renewable. Other sectors are more challenging. We're getting there on light transportation with electric vehicles, which I'll put in a plug for, but heavier forms of transportation are hard. Certain industries are hard. Anything that's hard to electrify is particularly difficult because the electricity sector is amenable to electrification and renewable energy is generally electricity, but sectors where electricity doesn't work are the most difficult.
And I think there are actually some low-hanging fruit where the U.S. can make a big impact, which is energy efficiency. If we look at energy efficiency of buildings, for instance, of existing buildings to retrofit them, and of new buildings, and just even looking at energy efficiency of appliances and things like that, of heating systems, there's a big potential, I think, where the U.S. has quite some potential to reduce emissions. It's not going to be enough or not even close, but I think this is at least something that can be done within a reasonable time frame.
Okay, we'll move to Nirmal, who asks, climate is a central theme and all of economy agreed, but are there still no-go areas like arms and conflict? The United States Armed Forces, for instance, alone has a notoriously massive CO2 footprint.
I'll just say a couple words on this one. One of those is that during the Trump administration, the U.S. military was probably the most climate forward part of the government. And the reason why is because the military's job is to think of threats and future threats in a changing environment and what it means for the security of the United States. And they take that seriously. And so they didn't set climate aside in the way many other parts of the Trump administration did. That said, the U.S. military does have a very large CO2 footprint. They are certainly looking at that. I personally have talked to people in the military who are thinking about that. And a reason why it's important to them is you think of the logistics and the challenge of moving all the fuel around that they need. That's a significant pain point for them and also a point of vulnerability for them. So they have reasons to want to change and they understand the problem, but it is a difficult area to work in.
Do we have any other comments on that? Okay. In that case, I'm going to pose a question we received from Oliver Millman. This is for Nate. It goes back to the NDC. He asks, how much clout with other countries will the U.S. NDC have this time around compared to the last? Are major emitters looking to the U.S. as much as last time, or has the whole landscape changed?
great question. So I think the last point is valid, which is that there are some others have made this point as well. The U.S. is still a critical actor in the climate space. We are, you know, the world's number one economy, number two emitter, and also clearly still have a lot of, you know, kind of leadership in the international community. So those elements are very important. And that means that the, you know, the view of what the US NDC is also important. At the same time, there has also been a lot more action across other countries. So it's no longer the case that, say, the US is the major leader on climate. Like, there's lots of other countries that are doing a lot. So it's important to recognize that in many countries, and, you know, even key emitters, in a lot of places, climate action is happening. It's more mainstream. It's kind of going forward in a non-controversial way in many places. So that's fair. But I think as people are looking to the US, you know, it is important to be seen as credible. And I think, you know, it's important to be credible, right? Like, ultimately, you know, what we're talking about is, you know, basically, are we thinking about the right national climate strategy? Are we building the right economy over time? Are we grounding that in the right policy strategy? Also kind of, you know, the politics of it, like, that's part of a strategy, that it has to be recognizing that all of these elements are in play, because we're trying to retool our economy and do it rapidly, quickly, and effectively with, you know, jobs and economic, you know, positive jobs and economic impacts. So that's the core of it. And I think that if we can root our strategy in that kind of thinking, the credibility factor goes up. Similarly, I think it's also fair to point to the fact that, yes, we have had, as I think Sanjay mentioned, you know, kind of the oscillation at the presidential level, but at the same time, you know, we are in a world today that is different. And I laid out a few ways I see it as different in my opening comment, but the world is different today in the US. And that means that, you know, looking at the US action, looking at what, you know, might be put on the table by the Biden administration, what others might see, and I hope they do, is that the world has changed, and that the US is basing this set of, you know, basing this target that we'll put on the table on a set of policies and strategies that are grounded in a kind of broader base of existing action, which is, again, we have had this story of subnational action in the United States over the past few years. One statistic I like to share on that is that, you know, work we've done shows that coalition of actors, even before the federal government re-entered, represented something like 70% of US GDP. That's equivalent to in size to the world's second largest economy, roughly the size of China, that's been working on climate action, using the policy levers available to them, which in many cases are quite significant, if you think about states and electricity policy, for example. So there is a kind of credibility story there. I think that the ultimate reality of what is in the national strategy will be the best signal to the international community about how we're going to be doing this.
Great. Thank you so much, Nate and Oliver, for the question. I'm going to turn to Owen Churchill, who posed a question in the chat. He says he's curious to hear the panelists' expectations around new commitments, if any, from China at or following the summit. And beyond coal financing, as mentioned earlier, what are the most critical areas in which China needs to accelerate progress?
Maybe I can start that a little provocatively. Actually, for China, it's coal, coal, and coal. That's where the ambition has to be, in the sense that, you know, China consumes, coal in three ways that are really puts it at the top end. First, it consumes a lot of coal inside the home. Second, it uses coal for hard-to-abate sectors like steel. And of course, it uses coal for energy generation. It has come down from 80% to about 57%, but still very high. And it is still continuing to build coal-fired power plants. So for the peaking of carbon emissions in China, you know, accelerating the phase out of coal will be of critical importance. On the other side, China is absolutely the world's leader on renewables. So, you know, it has the potential in some sense to take a very aggressive approach. And there are policy issues here, For example, you know, there are quite a lot of disincentives in the way the grid is structured against renewables and towards coal. So there are a lot, you know, there's a lot of potential in China. China recognizes it. There's a lot of internal debate and discussion going on. And of course, like everywhere else, pricing, carbon will make a big difference.
Yeah, I completely agree with that assessment.
Quick note on that. So totally agree. We've done a lot of work on China coal decarbonization strategies, sometimes with Chinese partners. That is a critical question. And the thing that I will note is that the Chinese, I mentioned this at the top, the Chinese net zero 2060 target implies is, by the way, you know, was surprising and I think positive globally that came out a few months back. That implies a different trajectory in coal than what is currently happening. And so China has the situation where they've basically put out a policy that is, you know, this is, by the way, it's not unique to China. Many countries have this situation, including ours, sometimes a policy that sort of says, here's our long-term goal, but our current trajectory is off track. And so there's going to have to be, if they want to hit that 2060 net zero, there will have to be a retooling and a strategy to rapidly phase out some of their low-hanging fruit plants to kind of probably have a retirement strategy for some of the plants that have been built in a little bit older in a little bit older vintages, and also, frankly, immediately halt the new construction of coal plants. I mean, those are kind of the three things they have to do. There's ways they can do that. That's kind of more and less in line with their kind of nationally sort of set goals of how to kind of nurture their economy and all this. But ultimately, those are the implied actions that they'll have to be taking.
And I think just to add to this, one critical aspect of the of China will be how well their carbon market will work. I mean, if they can make the carbon market work and have a bite to really kind of affect emissions, that's going to be a game changer. It's going to be the largest carbon market in the world. And if it will be linked eventually to the European one, I think that has a big potential. And the second thing I think we haven't talked about much yet is that the Chinese kind of like they have a two-pronged strategy, I would say. On the one hand, obviously, they have a lot of the coal-fired power plants still, and they rely on it to a large extent. But on the other hand, they invest extremely large amounts in renewable energies. They're trying to become leaders in innovation in those areas. And I think this is really where the U.S. has historically had strength, right? Some innovation, coming up with new ideas to maybe find new low-carbon technologies. And I think if the U.S. doesn't want to be left behind, investments in that sector are critical so that we come up with new technologies and that we're the leaders in some of those industries will be created here rather than in other countries.
All right, we have just about 2 minutes left, and Lisa Friedman has a follow-up question. She's wondering if any of you think that the United States is on a path right now to meet its current Paris target.
I'll say a couple of words because I actually looked into this yesterday and then maybe pass it off to Nate. When I looked yesterday, it appears that the U.S. emissions from 2020 last year are actually roughly in line with the less ambitious bound of our 2025 NDC that we set, you know, at the beginning of the Paris Agreement. But it's really only because of the pandemic. That's what took the emissions down last year. It's not policy. It's not a sustainable way to achieve those emissions. But we did kind of hit the low end of our goal entirely because of the pandemic. In order to make more progress, clearly we need more policy.
Quick response, Elisa, good question. The short answer is, looks like we in line with Samantha's comment, maybe yes, we might hit it. We might fall somewhat short of it, but kind of in the zone. The reasons why for that, why that's case is somewhat complex. So I don't think we have time to go into that right now. And not all, frankly, reasons that we would sort of normally program in, like we had a COVID and economic recession. So not the way we would normally want to depress emissions.
All right. Well, we are at time, but thank you all so much for your questions. And thank you to our four scholars on the line for their time and expertise. As I said at the beginning of the call, This has been recorded and is on the record, so I will be sending out a transcript just as soon as I get it to everyone who has registered for this. So be on the lookout for that, hopefully in the next day or two. So yeah, thank you all so much.